Chapter 17. Home on the Cloud. In 2011, I was back in the States, working for the same nominal employer, Dell, but now attached to my old agency, the CIA. One mild spring day, I came home from my first day at the new job and was amused to notice the house I'd moved into had a mailbox. It was nothing fancy, just one of those subdivided rectangles common to townhouse communities, but still, it made me smile. I hadn't had a mailbox in years, and hadn't ever checked this one. I might not even have registered its existence had it not been overflowing, stuffed to bursting with heaps of junk mail addressed to Mr. Edward J. Snowden or current resident. The envelopes contained coupons and ad circulars for household products. Someone knew that I'd just moved in. A memory surfaced from my childhood, a memory of checking the mail and finding a letter to my sister. Although I wanted to open it, my mother wouldn't let me. I remember asking why. "Because," she said, "it's not addressed to you." She explained that opening mail intended for someone else, even if it was just a birthday card or a chain letter, wasn't a very nice thing to do. In fact, it was a crime. I wanted to know what kind of crime. "A big one, buddy," my mother said. "A federal crime." I stood in the parking lot, tore the envelopes in half, and carried them to the trash. I had a new iPhone in the pocket of my new Ralph Lauren suit. I had new Burberry glasses, a new haircut, keys to this new townhouse in Columbia, Maryland, the largest place I'd ever lived in, and the first place that really felt like mine. I was rich, or at least my friends thought so. I barely recognized myself. I'd decided it was best to live in denial and just make some money, make life better for the people I loved. After all, wasn't that what everybody else did? But it was easier said than done. The denial, I mean. The money, that came easy. So easy that I felt guilty. Counting Geneva, and not counting periodic trips home, I'd been away for nearly 4 years. The America I returned to felt like a changed country. I won't go as far as to say that I felt like a foreigner, but I did find myself mired in way too many conversations I didn't understand. Every other word was the name of some TV show or movie I didn't know, or a celebrity scandal I didn't care about, and I couldn't respond. I had nothing to respond with. Contradictory thoughts rained down like Tetris blocks, and I struggled to sort them out, to make them disappear. I thought, pity these poor, sweet, innocent people. They're victims, watched by the government, watched by the very screens they worship. Then I thought, shut up. Stop being so dramatic. They're happy. They don't care, and you don't have to either. Grow up, do your work, pay your bills. That's life. A normal life was what Lindsay and I were hoping for. We were ready for the next stage and had decided to settle down. We had a nice backyard with a cherry tree that reminded me of a sweeter Japan. A spot on the Tama River, where Lindsay and I had laughed and rolled around atop the fragrant carpet of Tokyo blossoms as we watched the sakura fall. Lindsay was getting certified as a yoga instructor. I, meanwhile, was getting used to my new position. In sales. One of the external vendors I'd worked with on Epic Shelter ended up working for Dell and convinced me that I was wasting my time with getting paid by the hour. I should get into the sales side of Dell's business, he said, where I could earn a fortune for more ideas like Epic Shelter. I'd be making an astronomical leap up the corporate ladder, and he'd be getting a substantial referral bonus. I was ready to be convinced, especially since it meant distracting myself from my growing sense of unease, which could only get me into trouble. The official job title was Solutions Consultant. It meant, in essence, that I had to solve the problems created by my new partner, whom I'm going to call Cliff, the account manager. Cliff was supposed to be the face, and I was to be the brain. When we sat down with the CIA's technical royalty and purchasing agents, his job was to sell Dell's equipment and expertise by any means necessary. This meant reaching deep into the seat of his pants for unlimited, slick promises as to how we'd do things for the agency, things that were definitely, definitely not possible for our competitors, and in reality, not possible for us either. My job was to lead a team of experts in building something that reduced the degree to which Cliff had lied by just enough that when the person who signed the check pressed the power button, we wouldn't all be sent to jail. No pressure. Our main project was to help the CIA catch up with the bleeding edge, or just with the technical standards of the NSA, by building it the buzziest of new technologies, a private cloud. The aim was to unite the agency's processing and storage while distributing the ways by which data could be accessed. In plain American, we wanted to make it so that someone in a tent in Afghanistan could do exactly the same work in exactly the same way as someone at CIA headquarters. The agency, and indeed the whole IC's technical leadership, was constantly complaining about silos. The problem of having a billion buckets of data spread all over the world that they couldn't keep track of or access. So I was leading a team of some of the smartest people at Dell to come up with a way that anyone, anywhere, could reach anything. During the proof of concept stage, the working name of our cloud became Frankie. Don't blame me. On the tech side, we just called it the private cloud. It was Cliff who named it, in the middle of a demo with the CIA, saying they were going to love our little Frankenstein because it's a real monster. The more promises Cliff made, the busier I became, leaving Lindsay and me only the weekends to catch up with our parents and old friends. We tried to furnish and equip our new home. The three-story place had come empty, so we had to get everything, or everything that our parents hadn't generously handed down to us. This felt very mature, but was at the same time very telling about our priorities. We bought dishes, cutlery, a desk, and a chair, but we still slept on a mattress on the floor. I'd become allergic to credit cards with all their tracking, so we bought everything outright with hard currency. When we needed a car, I bought a 98 Acura Integra from a classified ad for $3,000 cash. Earning money was one thing, but neither Lindsay nor I liked to spend it, unless it was for computer equipment or a special occasion. For Valentine's Day, I bought Lindsay the revolver she'd always wanted. Our new condo was a 20-minute drive from nearly a dozen malls, including the Columbia Mall, which has nearly 1.5 million square feet of shopping, occupied by some 200 stores, a 14-screen AMC multiplex, a P.F. Chang's, and a Cheesecake Factory. As we drove the familiar roads in the beat-up Integra, I was impressed, but also slightly taken aback by all the development that had occurred in my absence. The post-9/11 government spending spree had certainly put a lot of money into a lot of local pockets. It was an unsettling and even overwhelming experience to come back to America after having been away for a while and to realize anew just how wealthy this part of the country was and how many consumer options it offered. How many big box retailers and high-end interior design showrooms. And all of them had sales for President's Day, Memorial Day, Independence Day, Labor Day, Columbus Day, Veterans Day. Festive banners announced the latest discounts just below all the flags. Our mission was pretty much appliance-based on this one afternoon I'm recalling. We were at Best Buy. Having settled on a new microwave, we were checking out, on Lindsay's healthful insistence, a display of blenders. She had her phone out and was in the midst of researching which of the 10 or so devices had the best reviews when I found myself wandering over to the computer department at the far end of the store. But along the way, I stopped. There, at the edge of the kitchenware section, ensconced atop a brightly decorated and lit elevated platform, was a shiny new refrigerator. Rather, it was a smart fridge, which was being advertised as internet-equipped. This, plain and simple, blew my mind. A salesperson approached, interpreting my stupefaction as interest. "It's amazing, isn't it?" and proceeded to demonstrate a few of the features. A screen was embedded in the door of the fridge, and next to the screen was a holder for a tiny stylus, which allowed you to scribble messages. If you didn't want to scribble, you could record audio and video memos. You could also use the screen as you would your regular computer, because the refrigerator had Wi-Fi. You could check your email or check your calendar. You could watch YouTube clips or listen to MP3s. You could even make phone calls. I had to restrain myself from keying in Lindsay's number and saying from across the floor, "I'm calling from a fridge." Beyond that, the salesperson continued, the fridge's computer kept track of internal temperature and, through scanning barcodes, the freshness of your food. It also provided nutritional information and suggested recipes. I think the price was over $9,000, delivery included, the salesperson said. I remember driving home in a confused silence. This wasn't quite the stunning moonshot tech future we'd been promised. I was convinced that the only reason that thing was internet equipped was so that it could report back to its manufacturer about its owner's usage and about any other household data that was obtainable. The manufacturer, in turn, would monetize that data by selling it. And we were supposed to pay for the privilege. I wondered what the point was of getting so worked up over government surveillance if my friends, neighbors, and fellow citizens were more than happy to invite corporate surveillance into their homes, allowing themselves to be tracked while browsing in their pantries as efficiently as if they were browsing the web. It would still be another half decade before the domotics revolution, before virtual assistants like Amazon Echo and Google Home were welcomed into the bedroom and placed proudly on nightstands to record and transmit all activity within range, to log all habits and preferences, not to mention fetishes and kinks, which would then be developed into advertising algorithms and converted into cash. The data we generate just by living, or just by letting ourselves be surveilled while living, would enrich private enterprise and impoverish our private existence in equal measure. If government surveillance was having the effect of turning the citizen into a subject at the mercy of state power, then corporate surveillance was turning the consumer into a product, which corporations sold to other corporations, data brokers, and advertisers. Meanwhile, it felt as if every major tech company, including Dell, was rolling out new civilian versions of what I was working on for the CIA, a cloud. In fact, Dell had even tried 4 years previously to trademark the term cloud computing, but was denied. I was amazed at how willingly people were signing up, so excited at the prospect of their photos and videos and music and ebooks being universally backed up and available that they never gave much thought as to why such an uber-sophisticated and convenient storage solution was being offered to them for free or for cheap in the first place. I don't think I'd ever seen such a concept be so uniformly bought into on every side. The cloud was as effective a sales term for Dell to sell to the CIA as it was for Amazon and Apple and Google to sell to their users. I can still close my eyes and hear Cliff schmoozing some CIA suit about how, with the cloud, you'll be able to push security updates across agency computers worldwide. Or, when the cloud's up and running, the agency will be able to track who has read what file worldwide. The cloud was white and fluffy and peaceful, floating high above the fray. Though many clouds make a stormy sky, a single cloud provided a benevolent bit of shade. It was protective. I think it made everyone think of heaven. Dell, along with the largest cloud-based private companies, Amazon, Apple, and Google, regarded the rest of the cloud as a new age of computing. But in concept, at least, it was something of a regression to the old mainframe architecture of computing's earliest history, where many users all depended upon a single, powerful, central core that could only be maintained by an elite cadre of professionals. The world had abandoned this impersonal mainframe model only a generation before, once businesses like Dell developed personal computers, cheap enough and simple enough to appeal to mortals. The renaissance that followed produced desktops, laptops, tablets, and smartphones, all devices that allowed people the freedom to make an immense amount of creative work. The only issue was how to store it. That was the genesis of cloud computing. Now, it didn't really matter what kind of personal computer you had, because the real computers that you relied upon were warehoused in the enormous data centers that the cloud companies built throughout the world. These were, in a sense, the new mainframes. Row after row of racked, identical servers linked together in such a way that each individual machine acted together within a collective computing system. The loss of a single server or even an entire data center no longer mattered, because they were mere droplets in the larger, global cloud. From the standpoint of a regular user, a cloud is just a storage mechanism that ensures that your data is being processed or stored not on your personal device, but on a range of different servers, which can ultimately be owned and operated by different companies. The result is that your data is no longer truly yours. It's controlled by companies, which can use it for virtually any purpose. Read your terms of service agreements for cloud storage, which get longer and longer by the year. Current ones are over 6,000 words, twice the average length of one of these book chapters. When we choose to store our data online, we're often ceding our claim to it. Companies can decide what type of data they will hold for us and can willfully delete any data they object to. Unless we've kept a separate copy on our own machines or drives, this data will be lost to us forever. If any of our data is found to be particularly objectionable or otherwise in violation of the terms of service, the companies can unilaterally delete our accounts, deny us our own data, and yet retain a copy for their own records, which they can turn over to the authorities without our knowledge or consent. Ultimately, the privacy of our data depends on the ownership of our data. There is no property less protected, and yet no property more private. The internet I'd grown up with, the internet that had raised me, was disappearing. And with it, so was my youth. The very act of going online, which had once seemed like a marvelous adventure, now seemed like a fraught ordeal. Self-expression now required such strong self-protection as to obviate its liberties and nullify its pleasures. Every communication was a matter not of creativity, but of safety. Every transaction was a potential danger. Meanwhile, the private sector was busy leveraging our reliance on technology into market consolidation. The majority of American internet users lived their entire digital lives on email, social media, and e-commerce platforms owned by an imperial triumvirate of companies, Google, Facebook, and Amazon. And the American IC was seeking to take advantage of that fact by obtaining access to their networks, both through direct orders that were kept secret from the public and clandestine subversion efforts that were kept secret from the companies themselves. Our user data was turning vast profits for the companies, and the government pilfered it for free. I don't think I'd ever felt so powerless. Then there was this other emotion I felt, a curious sense of being adrift and yet at the same time of having my privacy violated. It was as if I were dispersed, with parts of my life scattered across servers all over the globe and yet intruded or imposed upon. Every morning when I left our townhouse, I found myself nodding at the security cameras dotted throughout our development. Previously, I'd never paid them any attention, but now, when a light turned red on my commute, I couldn't help but think of its leering sensor, keeping tabs on me whether I blew through the intersection or stopped. License plate readers were recording my comings and goings, even if I maintained a speed of 35 miles per hour. America's fundamental laws exist to make the job of law enforcement not easier, but harder. This isn't a bug. It's a core feature of democracy. In the American system, law enforcement is expected to protect citizens from one another. In turn, the courts are expected to restrain that power when it's abused and to provide redress against the only members of society with the domestic authority to detain, arrest, and use force, including lethal force. Among the most important of those restraints are the prohibitions against law enforcement surveilling private citizens on their property and taking possession of their private recordings without a warrant. There are few laws, however, that restrain the surveillance of public property, which includes the vast majority of America's streets and sidewalks. Law enforcement's use of surveillance cameras on public property was originally conceived of as a crime deterrent and an aid to investigators after a crime had occurred. But as the cost of these devices continued to fall, they became ubiquitous, and their role became preemptive, with law enforcement using them to track people who had not committed or were not even suspected of any crime. And the greatest danger still lies ahead, with the refinement of artificial intelligence capabilities such as facial and pattern recognition. An AI-equipped surveillance camera would be no mere recording device, but could be made into something closer to an automated police officer, a true RoboCop, actively seeking out suspicious activity, such as apparent drug deals, that is, people embracing or shaking hands, and apparent gang affiliation, such as people wearing specific colors and brands of clothing. Even in 2011, it was clear to me that this was where technology was leading us, without any substantive public debate. Potential monitoring abuses piled up in my mind to cumulatively produce a vision of an appalling future. A world in which all people were totally surveilled would logically become a world in which all laws were totally enforced, automatically, by computers. After all, it's difficult to imagine an AI device that's capable of noticing a person breaking the law, not holding that person accountable. No policing algorithm would ever be programmed, even if it could be, toward leniency or forgiveness. I wondered whether this would be the final but grotesque fulfillment of the original American promise that all citizens would be equal before the law, an equality of oppression through total automated law enforcement. I imagined the future smart fridge stationed in my kitchen, monitoring my conduct and habits, and using my tendency to drink straight from the carton or not wash my hands to evaluate the probability of my being a felon. Such a world of total automated law enforcement, of, say, all pet ownership laws or all zoning laws regulating home businesses, would be intolerable. Extreme justice can turn out to be extreme injustice, not just in terms of the severity of punishment for an infraction, but also in terms of how consistently and thoroughly the law is applied and prosecuted. Nearly every large and long-lived society is full of unwritten laws that everyone is expected to follow, along with vast libraries of written laws that no one is expected to follow or even know about. According to Maryland Criminal Law Section 10-501, adultery is illegal and punishable by a $10 fine. In North Carolina, Statute 14-309.8 makes it illegal for a bingo game to last more than 5 hours. Both of these laws come from a more prudish past, and yet, for one reason or another, were never repealed. Most of our lives, even if we don't realize it, occur not in black and white, but in a gray area, where we jaywalk, put trash in the recycling bin and recyclables in the trash, ride our bicycles in the improper lane, and borrow a stranger's Wi-Fi to download a book that we didn't pay for. Put simply, a world in which every law is always enforced would be a world in which everyone was a criminal. I tried to talk to Lindsay about all this, but though she was generally sympathetic to my concerns, she wasn't so sympathetic that she was ready to go off the grid, or even off Facebook or Instagram. If I did that, she said, I'd be giving up my art and abandoning my friends. You used to like being in touch with other people. She was right. And she was right to be worried about me. She thought I was too tense and under too much stress. I was, not because of my work, but because of my desire to tell her a truth that I wasn't allowed to. I couldn't tell her that my former co-workers at the NSA could target her for surveillance and read the love poems she texted me. I couldn't tell her that they could access all the photos she took, not just her public photos, but the intimate ones. I couldn't tell her that her information was being collected, that everyone's information was being collected, which was tantamount to a government threat. If you ever get out of line, we'll use your private life against you. I tried to explain it to her obliquely through an analogy. I told her to imagine opening up her laptop one day and finding a spreadsheet on her desktop. "Why?" she said. "I don't like spreadsheets." I wasn't prepared for this response, so I just said the first thing that came to mind. Nobody does, but this one's called The End. Ooh, mysterious. You don't remember having created this spreadsheet, but once you open it up, you recognize its contents, because inside it is everything, absolutely everything, that could ruin you. Every speck of information that could destroy your life. Lindsay smiled. "Can I see the one for you?" She was joking, but I wasn't. A spreadsheet containing every scrap of data about you would pose a mortal hazard. Imagine it. All the secrets, big and small, that could end your marriage, end your career, poison even your closest relationships, and leave you broke, friendless, and in prison. Maybe the spreadsheet would include the joint you smoked last weekend at a friend's house, or the one line of cocaine you snorted off the screen of your phone in a bar in college, or the drunken one-night stand you had with your friend's girlfriend, who's now your friend's wife, which you both regret and have agreed never to mention to anyone, or an abortion you got when you were a teenager, which you kept hidden from your parents and that you'd like to keep hidden from your spouse. Or maybe it's just information about a petition you signed or a protest you attended. Everyone has something, some compromising information buried among their bytes. If not in their files, then in their email. If not in their email, then in their browsing history. And now this information was being stored by the U.S. government. Sometime after our exchange, Lindsay came up to me and said, "I figured out what would be on my spreadsheet of total destruction. The secret that would ruin me." "What?" "I'm not going to tell you." I tried to chill, but I kept having strange physical symptoms. I'd become weirdly clumsy, falling off ladders more than once, or bumping into door frames. Sometimes I'd trip or drop spoons I was holding or fail to gauge distances accurately and miss what I was reaching for. I'd spill water over myself or choke on it. Lindsay and I would be in the middle of a conversation when I'd miss what she'd said, and she'd ask where I'd gone to. It was like I'd been frozen in another world. One day, when I went to meet Lindsay after her pole fitness class, I started feeling dizzy. This was one of the most disturbing of the symptoms that I'd had thus far. It scared me, and it scared Lindsay, too, especially when it led to a gradual diminishing of my senses. I had too many explanations for these incidents: poor diet, lack of exercise, lack of sleep. I had too many rationalizations. The plate was too close to the edge of the counter. The stairs were slippery. I couldn't make up my mind whether it was worse if what I was experiencing was psychosomatic or genuine. I decided to go to the doctor, but the only appointment wasn't for weeks. A day or so later, I was home around noon, trying my best to keep up with work remotely. I was on the phone with a security officer, Adele, when the dizziness hit me hard. I immediately excused myself from the call, slurring my words, and as I struggled to hang up the phone, I was sure I was going to die. For those who've experienced it, this sense of impending doom needs no description. And for those who haven't, there is no explanation. It strikes so suddenly and primally that it wipes out all other feeling, all thought, besides helpless resignation. My life was over. I slumped in my chair, a big black padded Aeron that tilted underneath me as I fell into a void and lost consciousness. I came to, still seated, with the clock on my desk reading just shy of 1 p.m. I'd been out less than an hour, but I was exhausted. It was as if I'd been awake since the beginning of time. I reached for the phone in a panic, but my hand kept missing it and grabbing the air. Once I managed to grab a hold of it and get a dial tone, I found I couldn't remember Lindsay's number, or could only remember the digits, but not their order. Somehow I managed to get myself downstairs, taking each step deliberately, palm against the wall. I got some juice out of the fridge and chugged it, keeping both hands on the carton and dribbling a fair amount on my chin. Then I lay down on the floor, pressed my cheek to the cool linoleum, and fell asleep, which was how Lindsay found me. I'd just had an epileptic seizure. My mother had epilepsy, and for a time at least was prone to grand mal seizures, the foaming at the mouth, her limbs thrashing, her body rolling around until it stilled into a horrible, unconscious rigidity. I couldn't believe I hadn't previously associated my symptoms with hers, though that was the very same denial she herself had been in for decades, attributing her frequent falls to clumsiness and lack of coordination. She hadn't been diagnosed until her first grand mal in her late 30s, and after a brief spell on medication, her seizures stopped. She'd always told me and my sister that epilepsy wasn't hereditary, and to this day I'm still not sure if that's what her doctor had told her, or if she was just trying to reassure us that her fate wouldn't be ours. There is no diagnostic test for epilepsy. The clinical diagnosis is just two or more unexplained seizures. That's it. Very little is known about the condition. Medicine tends to treat epilepsy phenomenologically. Doctors don't talk about epilepsy, they talk about seizures. They tend to divide seizures into two types, localized and generalized. The former being an electrical misfire in a certain section of your brain that doesn't spread. The latter being an electrical misfire that creates a chain reaction. Basically, a wave of misfiring synapses rolls across your brain, causing you to lose motor function and ultimately consciousness. Epilepsy is such a strange syndrome. Its sufferers feel different things depending on which part of the brain has the initial electrical cascade failure. Those who have this failure in their auditory center famously hear bells. Those who have it in their visual center either have their vision go dark or see sparkles. If the failure happens in the deeper core areas of the brain, which was where mine occurred, it can cause severe vertigo. In time, I came to know the warning signs, so I could prepare for an oncoming seizure. These signs are called auras in the popular language of epilepsy, though in scientific fact, these auras are the seizure itself. They are the proprioceptive experience of the misfire. I consulted with as many epilepsy specialists as I could find. The best part of working for Dell was the insurance. I had CAT scans, MRIs, the works. Meanwhile, Lindsay, who was my stalwart angel throughout all this, driving me back and forth from appointments, went about researching all the information that was available about the syndrome. She Googled both allopathic and homeopathic treatments so intensely that basically all her Gmail ads were for epilepsy pharmaceuticals. I felt defeated. The two great institutions of my life had been betrayed and were betraying me, my country, and the internet. And now my body was following suit. My brain had quite literally short-circuited.